Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Biden's address today to the United Nations, in which he declared the world is at an inflection point, with climate change and pandemics threatening the planet. Earlier, the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned that, quote, the world is on a catastrophic pathway, and that current climate pledges are inadequate, and still missing are new pledges from 70 countries, including China, Saudi Arabia, India, Brazil, Mexico, and Russia. Joining us is Barbara Crosset, the senior consulting editor and writer covering the UN for Pass Blue at passblue.com, and the United Nations correspondent for The Nation, who was previously the UN bureau chief for The New York Times. We'll discuss Biden's efforts to get world leaders to be more serious about dealing with climate change, and his pledges to get more vaccines out to where they are needed, making it clear that the US by far is distributing the most and the most effective vaccines to poorer nations. Then we'll get an analysis of last weekend's rigged Russian elections, in which Google and Apple cooperated with Putin's government to stymie the opposition's plans to direct votes away from Putin's party via an app that was banned. A professor of Russian studies at the University of Florida and an expert on Russian language and political culture and the impact of social media on Russian politics, Michael Gorham, joins us to discuss how Putin still seems to want the appearance of democratic legitimacy, even as he goes to increasingly brazen lengths to ensure his party wins. Then finally, we'll examine the fiscal year 2022 National Defense Authorization Act, which already has 800 amendments and has hawks on both sides pushing to add an extra $24 billion, even though the U.S. is ending its wars in the Middle East. Joining us to discuss this disconnect is Kelly Vlahos, a senior advisor at the Quincy Institute and editorial director of Responsible Statecraft, who is on the board of PublicSquare.net, a nonprofit media project promoting informed left-right debate, and is the co-host of the Crashing the War Party podcast. And before we go to our first guest, now that I have moved fully to online broadcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where we will be depending upon you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program alive during the critical years ahead in which the fate of American democracy will be decided. For those of you who can, help us keep delivering a daily briefing so that those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate can also join in the fight against disinformation, whether it comes from Mar-a-Lago or Moscow. We must win the political warfare battles underway and fight with weaponized facts to save our democracy as we create a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now, Barbara Crosset, who's a senior consulting editor and writer for Pass Blue at the New School Graduate Program in International Studies and the United Nations correspondent for The Nation. Previously was the UN Bureau Chief for The New York Times, and before that is Chief Correspondent in Southeast Asia and South Asia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Barbara Crosset.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for joining us. And what did you make of President Biden's speech today at the UN? He wanted to convince the United Nations that America is back. I think people were pretty skeptical going in. So how did he do?
Well, in fact, and by the way, I write a lot for PassBlue.com, which is a small news site in New York that covers the UN and international affairs. So that's where I wrote this, just in case you need to know. Well, a lot of the things he said are things that no American would find unusual. In other words, he wanted to make the case, I think, less that the UN, that the U.S. is back, which he's been saying, I think, or his administration has been saying. But I think what he, I'm trying to get it up on the screen, but he what really wanted to say is that the U.S. had never left, and his administration was looking for ways to, you know, restart productive engagement. He called the UN a team of nations, and the quote was, in this noble mission of this institution. He was absolutely laudatory of the international system all the way through. He didn't name names. People expected him to attack China or make some comment on China or perhaps some other country. The only countries he mentioned were some of the countries which he sees proof that democracy is not dead. I mean, that's a sort of backhanded way of saying it, but he talked about, he was inspired by the democratic movements in places like Belarus, Burma. He used Syria, Cuba, and Venezuela as authoritarian places where there's still journalists, human rights defenders, and other people who are trying to protest the situation they have to live under. Otherwise, he went through the list of things that the U.S. in fact is doing under his administration. And as I said, most Americans might know these, but it's interesting the ones he chose. He talked about the huge amount of money and effort that the U.S. has put into the COVID vaccine initiatives, international initiatives. He said he spent $2 billion so far on this. 160 doses of COVID vaccines have been distributed globally by the United States in their own aircraft. They just delivered them to, he said, almost 100 countries. He didn't say that today. He said that the other day. But anyway, today he said there were 500 million more doses on order from Pfizer for the developing world. He talked about Afghanistan, but again, with a sunnier, his theme was this: let's not talk about the past, let's talk about the future and how we can get back into the game. He said on Afghanistan instead of continuing to fight the wars of the past, we are fixing our eyes on devoting our resources to the challenge that hold the keys to our collective future. He often used the phrase "we," talking about the United Nations family kind of thing, which is, you know, very strange after the performance put on by Trump that was, you know, it was just aggressive and nasty. And speaking of, a tenor of a speech, Biden was surprisingly more emphatic and outspoken. And he's often and loud, I guess I should say that. He spoke today, and I stumbled because I just come out of writing this. He came up very strong in his speech, stronger than most Americans hear when he gets up in front of that microphone in the White House. He seemed to rise to the occasion, and he was pretty forthright and pretty bold in claiming what he felt he had to say about where the United States stood now. He did, if you have time, he did talk quite a lot about, in a manner of speaking, about not a whole lot about Afghanistan, but he did see that as a proof that the United States is no longer involved in any war anywhere. And that's why he said we don't have to continue to fight the wars of the past. We've learned a lot, and we know where we were wrong. I'm making some of this up. However, I did have to say in this that he didn't talk about any of his internal problems. Now, the very day he's in New York, you know, making this speech, which is all pretty good, good news from America, there are so many divisions within his own party. His key proposals on in infrastructure and on social reform are in question within his own party. That he couldn't make a statement like this as positive about the situation in the United States as he feels he can make in dealing with the future of the international system. It interests us on specifics. He did give unambiguous support to the two-nation solution for Israel and what he called a viable, sovereign, and democratic Palestinian state, which... will upset some people, I think. And he then turned to the question of authoritarianism. And authoritarians, as he says, seeking to proclaim the end of democracy. And then he goes on to say, of all these countries that he listed, where there's strict authoritarianism, there are always people like journalists and human rights activists and others who are there to remind the world of what the situation is. So that was about it. You know, as I said, the details of things like the what the U.S. has done in COVID and so on, I think he has probably over time talked about that here. But of course, this is for a world audience. This is not for for an American audience. So many of these things that he's not been a terrific promoter of his own programs in this country. And so in many ways he was more specific today talking to the world than he does sometimes to an American audience. That's just my opinion. I don't cover national affairs. I just watch a lot of news.
Okay.
So you know, that's it. And the interesting thing today is instead of a virtual General Assembly session, which they had last year, more than 100 countries showed up at the UN, leaders of countries and their delegations. And there were only a few virtual spokespeople, and one of them was the president of China. He decided at the very last minute to come, and he didn't even use his 15 minutes of time up. It was a video from Beijing.
And again, I'm speaking with Barbara Crosset, who's a senior consulting editor and writer covering the United Nations for Pass Blue at passblue.com. And she's also the United Nations correspondent for The Nation and previously was the UN Bureau Chief for The New York Times. And before that, its chief correspondent in Southeast Asia and South Asia. So you mentioned Biden's speech about getting out of the wars of the past and looking forward to the challenges of the future. The table was set by the UN Secretary General Guterres in his alarming address, saying that the world is on a catastrophic pathway, talking about global warming and the extent to which it has to be addressed. So is there any sense particularly from the Chinese, that they're in that context, that they're understanding? I mean, in other words, the UN Secretary General set the table. Are the others participating?
Right. Yes, I would say because the Chinese president spoke for such a short period of time. Yeah, I think they all touched on these. I mean, I think that was the sort of menu since you're talking about setting the table. And tomorrow Biden, I think, yes, is going to have quite a long symposium or a summit meeting on COVID. They had something yesterday on climate change as side issues, but at summit level. That is, you know, that's their UN and UNEs for heads of government and heads of state, and so it's there. And I think from the developing countries, as you would imagine, there is deep anxiety about climate. And I thought Guterres' speech today to start the day was terrific, and it was terrifically pointed. As you say, it was brutal, and so. I don't think anybody quite rose to that. But anyway, they all talked. Now, for the president of the General Assembly for this year is from the Maldives. And the Maldives are a collection, as you know, of atolls in the Indian Ocean. And they're going to disappear. And it's the same with, I've heard people from the South Pacific say, all of my ancestors' graves are going to be covered with water. And so for the developing nations, particularly the coastal ones, when the seas rise, and the landlocked ones for other reasons, where there will be water shortages, you know, they spoke heatedly about this and how I don't know that they, because of their size, what can they do except ask the nations who are consuming a lot of the world's resources and not giving them enough money for adaptation, I think. But they were the most outspoken on climate. On the institutions of democracy, as I said, China just took a crack at it, saying basically you can't. I don't have his quote here right now. You can't enforce. No, he said you can't transform a culture with your ideas of how a government should be run or something. It was, in other words, don't push democracy down our throats. And he used that in connection with Afghanistan also. That was a mistake, he said, to misinterpret what you can do in a culture that's so different. And I don't think a lot of people would disagree with that. I've worked in Afghanistan a little, and it's just another world, and it's got worse. It hasn't got any better. So, you know, that kind of thing, that the smaller nations, the poorer nations, the developing nations, and of course they are also all complaining about the lack of help in treating the pandemic. They're convinced that more vaccines are being thrown away in the rich world because they get expired. They have an expiration date, and that means in the meantime the poor countries don't have access. So you know, there almost was a north-south divide, but not as much as often is the case. I was surprised it was a general good nature. That's too much for diplomats. There was a general cooperative feeling today that you don't always get at these big events. And I think it's partly because the UN has sort of resurfaced as a place, and because they took that that long speech from Guterres to heart, if that makes sense.
Well, prior to the Guterres speech, and of course, in Biden's appearance today, Biden did have a virtual summit meeting the other day with a number of world leaders, the UK, the EU, Argentina, Indonesia, etc. China sent lower level delegates, and Biden was pretty emphatic about the need. In this case, the focus was on reducing methane emissions by 30% by the end of the decade. So Biden seems to have a coherent agenda here. Dealing with methane is one of the more doable things. So you said he's going to be doing some more work on dealing with climate change tomorrow. Is he going to try and get the rest of the UN aboard his proposal?
No, I think tomorrow is COVID. Climate change was Monday. He has John Kerry with him in New York. There is, you know, the big Paris plus 20 or whatever it is coming up at the beginning of November this year in Glasgow. They're going to have another huge international meeting. So a lot of talk about this has been deferred to John Kerry, but he obviously didn't speak today because he's not a government leader. Tomorrow, I think most of it will be the COVID situation. And I think Biden feels on strong ground, because he says, and it's not a lie, unlike other people who lie, that the U.S. has spent more money on vaccines and distributed more vaccines than all the other countries combined. And, you know, India stopped selling vaccines in the developing world just when they were needed most. China has had some problems with their vaccines. And so, I think Biden feels it's a strong suit, and he can continue spending money. And getting the pharmaceutical companies donate more vaccine doses. The other thing that worries a lot of people in the developing world, apart from some of the vaccines being expired and thrown away, is the quality of the vaccines. There's just some concern that some of the countries that are making vaccines right and left are not doing it with the same pharmaceutical investment and knowledge as the bigger companies. So they really they don't want the leftovers and the handouts. They want good vaccines. And so Biden feels confident, I think, in saying, well, the U.S. is leading the way on that. There was a brief mentioned, no, not today, that was yesterday, the question of the flap with France over this new alliance to make nuclear-powered submarines has got a lot of attention, as you know, here, and that wasn't in his speech at all. I think he spoke for 34 minutes. He dodged a lot of the big controversies here, and in fact, the report from one of the reporters, who was waiting in the lobby before the event, said as he passed through the lobby into the General Assembly, people shouted at him about, I mean, what do you think of the French flag? And, you know, all that stuff. And he just said, thank you, thank you, thank you. And he walked past. So he didn't want to get involved in that, any of those things this time around.
So just in closing, then, it seems as though predictions that America's coming back and that the rest of the world is pretty skeptical about that. The impression I get from you is that maybe Biden is succeeding in convincing the rest of the world that America is back. At least America is not going backwards under the insane amateurism and danger of Donald Trump.
Well, I think he even starts with a higher level from which he builds, which is to say, you know, we've always done a lot of these things for ever. The U.S. has given more to humanitarian assistance in the world than any place else, that kind of thing. And that hasn't changed. He did talk about humanitarian assistance a bit, about, you know, the sort of what the kind of soft issues that the U.N. handles so well. He didn't talk about what's going to happen, you know, vis-a-vis the Afghans, but, and he didn't mention the Afghan women who are going to really take a hit. Anyway, no, I think he doesn't start with the idea that the U.S. has to crawl back. And I know that's how some people are taking this. I think he thinks the U.S. has the strength to take off from where it lost footing under the hideous last administration, which tried to damage as much of the U.N. system as it possibly could. And it didn't work. I mean, all the places he tried to shut down aren't, and all that stuff. So I don't think Biden feels he's starting at such a low level.
Well, Barbara Crosetta, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Barbara Crosetta, who is a senior consulting editor and writer covering the United Nations for Pass Blue at passblue.com. And she is also the United Nations correspondent for The Nation and previously was the UN Bureau Chief for The New York Times. And before that is Chief Correspondent in Southeast Asia and South Asia. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back with an analysis of last weekend's rigged Russian elections in which Google and Apple cooperated with the Putin government to stymie the opposition's plans to direct votes away from Putin's party.
This disguise the leaders, you know, for them. Them vomiting everywhere, who them reach America. Them call the place to United Nations. Yeah, oh, another animal talk. Waiting united inside United Nations. Who and who unite for United Nations?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Michael Gorham, who is a professor of Russian studies at the University of Florida and an associate editor of the Russian Review and Russian Language Journal. He's the author of After Newspeak, Language, Culture, and Politics in Russia from Gorbachev to Putin, and Speaking in Soviet Tongues, Language, Culture, and the Politics of Voice in Revolutionary Russia. And he's a specialist on language and political culture in Russia and the impact of social media on Russian politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Gorham.
Glad to be with you.
Well, thanks for joining us. And there's a clear impact of social media on politics because in this Duma election for the Russian parliament that just took place, the government forced both Apple and Google to drop the app that Navalny's people had put together in order to guide people to vote for other parties or other candidates instead of United Russia, Putin's party. And Google and Apple complied with the Russian government's order. I guess they were being threatened if they didn't. And it did seem to have an impact, did it not? I think Navalny was urging people to vote for communist candidates, and they seem to have done better. The communists received 22% of the vote compared to 13% in 2016. And of course, United Russia carried 44% of the vote, which is 10 points less than the previous election in 2016.
Yeah, the results were a little less glowing for the party of power, United Russia, but they still did manage to get a two-thirds majority of seats in the parliament, which allows them to rewrite the constitution in whatever ways the Kremlin deems it appropriate. But regardless of the last-minute attempts to limit access to this smart voting campaign headed by Navalny and his team, it appears that had the vote count been accurate and honest, the smart voting campaign still seems to have made a significant difference, particularly in the big cities such as Moscow and Petersburg. The problem is that the Putin administration has so many different tools that it's been using in order to rig elections that it, in the end, it can pretty much lean on other techniques if certain pressures don't work. But you're absolutely right. In this case, Apple and Google did agree to take the app out of their app stores. And whether or not that had an impact, I'm not so sure. Savvy Russian internet users have a way of getting information, particularly when it appears like the government is trying to suppress it.
Well, in terms of using other dirty tricks, Putin's people are seen on video stuffing ballots or stuffing papers into a ballot box. And there's reports from St. Petersburg that independent poll watchers were arrested by the police for simply trying to do their job. So, and by the way, this time around, there were no OECD poll watchers allowed, right, in this latest election.
That's right. So, I mean, you basically have at least three levels of rigging the elections. It's pretty much impossible for an opposition candidate to get even to get their name on the ballot if they're not part of the so-called systemic opposition, which is a strange term referring to the Communist Party and the Liberal Democratic Party, which have long been accepted opposition parties, as opposed to Navalny's party. So the first task is actually getting your name on the ballot, and it turns out that right there, it's nearly impossible. Secondly, there's a huge emphasis as far as getting the right people to the polls. This year in particular, there's a lot of reporting that civil servants had their arm twisted like they haven't had them twisted before. Reports of long lines at polling stations on the first day that you may have seen. And then finally, using various spoiler candidates and pseudo party, fake parties that kind of sound like the Communist Party to deflate the results there. By that time, you know, the ability to make any progress if you're a member of the opposition is close to nothing. And then, of course, counting the ballots and at that level, there's additional tools. This year, Russia introduced on a wide basis, a broad basis, especially in the cities, electronic voting, which turns out to have been a huge detriment to the Communist Party and to the Liberal Democratic Party, who by all measures were scheduled to make great gains in Moscow and Petersburg, in part because of Navalny's smart voting campaign. Even though those parties were leading up to the last minute, as soon as the electronic vote tallies came in, miraculously, the United Russia Party ended up winning all precincts in both cities, even though they were pretty much underdogs in the majority of those.
So that goes back to Stalin's famous quote that it doesn't matter who votes, it matters who counts the vote.
Yeah, that's very true. One wonders why, you know, at this point, why the Putin regime even bothers having these elections. They're so blatantly farcical, but he clearly does. It does matter to him the global perception of Russia as a democratic nation that has free and open elections. It helps his stature in his eyes, even though domestically he's not that beholden to everyday voters. But internationally, I guess it still matters to them. Otherwise, they'd just reintroduce the monarchy.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Gorham, who's a professor of Russian studies at the University of Florida and associate editor of the Russian Review and Russian Language Journal. He's the author of After Newspeak, Language, Culture, and Politics in Russia from Gorbachev to Putin, and Speaking in Soviet Tongues, Language, Culture, and the Politics of Voice in Revolutionary Russia. And he's an expert on language and political culture in Russia and the impact of social media on Russian politics. So Putin himself, of course, is not going to show up at the UN General Assembly meeting, which has started today, and is also, there's a outbreak of COVID amongst the inner circle in the Kremlin. So I don't know whether that's a factor, but apparently the Russians are very upset that the Sputnik vaccine has not been accepted by the UN. So the supporters for Putin still keep telling, you know, when they're interviewed, say that he's restored our pride and, you know, the Anglo-Saxons only understand force. Is that mentality still pervasive? I mean, it's hard not to see Putin as a Stalinist, frankly.
Well, it's his presidency is becoming more and more authoritarian. There's no doubt about that. But I think it would be a bit of a stretch to liken it to Stalinism, if for no other reason than the communications environment has changed dramatically, and the conditions are not really there for the sort of cult of personality that you had under Stalin. It's still very, very possible to criticize Putin and the Putin regime for all efforts that they make at suppressing that voice and restricting access to the internet. It still is pretty much open and free. That said, there has been since 2012 significant clampdowns, and given his calculation that he's pretty much lost 10 to 15% of the population of relatively educated Russians who are city dwellers, many young folks, he really has to appease sort of his Putin majority, which is the less educated, more regional, more rural population. And to do that, he plays the strong leader card, which is why you see a lot more pro-Stalin type of language coming out of people. Is surprising, who used to be deemed pretty moderate, people like Sergei Lavrov, the minister of foreign affairs, is now praising Stalin. So that I think is that's done mainly for domestic purposes. But as far as the structure of the country, I think we're still a ways away from the bad old 1930s and 40s.
Well, sure. I mean, Navalny, if Stalin were around, Navalny would be long dead, right?
That's the other thing. There's an issue of how willing you are to what extent you will go to do away with your opponents. And
it's not as if, though, they haven't tried to kill Navalny, though.
No. And he himself has documented that and pretty much outed the people who were behind it. So it's in that sense, you could argue that the security agencies are not as cohesive and strong as they were before, perhaps fighting amongst themselves in various realms. And it's much more of a personalized regime, I think, now than it was in the late Soviet period, so that you have one person rather than a Politburo making the calls. And that becomes very difficult, a system to manage.
But it is a system, essentially. If anybody runs Russia, apart from Putin himself, it's the security services, isn't it? I mean, they seem to regulate the oligarchs. They seem to control the business world, the media, you name it. It feels like the KGB is back.
Yeah, it has trended in that direction ever since the protest movements of 2011, 2012. Putin
reelected to his what would be his third term in 2012, when he basically recognized that was might be his only direction. And so you do see a lot more strength in those sectors, and more sacrifices being made at the expense of businesses, of the tech industry. Russia has one of the most creative tech sectors in the world, with super talented coders and engineers. But that's kind of playing, that's taking a back seat to the security matters, when they're in the process of essentially trying to create a Russian equivalent of the great firewall of China, even though the conditions aren't made for that, by walling off the Russian internet to the outside world. And that, of course, is maybe good for security, but it's super bad for business.
So in the last few minutes then, Michael Gorham, in terms of the Communist Party did well in this phony election, even though their votes were suppressed, and they came in second, and the Nationalists came in third. The Liberals are just about wiped out, aren't they? They don't exist, do they?
No, the Liberals, in the Western sense of the term, haven't really had a legitimate voice in the federal parliament since the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. The Yabloko party, headed by Grigory Yavlinsky, hasn't managed to meet that 5% threshold that's required to have representation in the federal parliament. So you have the Communist Party, which, as you say, is gaining in popularity. A lot of the votes it got this time around were probably protest votes, not only Navalny protest votes, but also regional protest votes. So I've seen some statisticians suggest that had the vote counting been on the up and up, or on the table, above the table, they still would have lost, but maybe by about 5 percentage points rather than what turned out to be 20 right. or 30 percentage points. After them, you have the Liberal Democratic Party, which is neither liberal nor democratic. It's more of a patriotic nationalist party. You have a center-right party and the Just Russia Party, coming in third or fourth, depending on what the final tally comes out. And then you have a party that was just created back in January. It was an effort to kind of steal votes from the Communist Party. It's called the New People Party, and it features some of the young, savvy, media-friendly bloggers and TV personalities. In a typical Surkov Putin effort to sort of muddy the waters and introduce some spoilers. And that party, the New People Party, managed to just reach that 5% threshold. So there's no sign of liberal voices in the Duma anywhere.
But in terms of the leader of the Communist Party, Gennady Zyuganov, he is furious at the election being stolen. They normally sort of are loyal to Putin on all the, particularly on foreign policy, etc. But he's now saying that he can't rule out that this will lead to mass protests. And he tweeted out on Saturday that, "I'm sure that people won't stand for a blatant substitution of their choice." So, do you think there could be any kind of protests, that if he's Putin losing the communists, even though they're, you know, the kind of token opposition, sounds like at least they're not going to put up with it?
Well, I'd never say never when it comes to Russia, but Zyuganov's been around long enough to know who pays the bills and who's responsible for his being such a long-standing figure in Russian politics. He is part of what is called the systemic opposition, meaning that he's only there because the Kremlin is okay with that. So I think if it were up to him, that we probably wouldn't see protests. But the interesting thing is there's a new generation of communists and people in the party who are pushing people like Zhukov, the old guard, to actually step up and confront the powers that be more aggressively. That said, the measures that the security agencies have taken in the past 6 or 7 years to crush protests and to create as much disincentive as possible, I think make it less likely that we're gonna see the masses turning out in the streets as a result of this. But there's no question that the rigging that we've just seen in the past few days is probably on par with the rigging that led to mass demonstrations, hundreds of thousands of people turning out in the streets back in 2011, 2012. It's just that the security climate has changed dramatically since then.
Well, Michael Gorham, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's my pleasure. Anytime.
Thanks again. And I've been speaking with Michael Gorham, Professor of Russian Studies at the University of Florida and Associate Editor of the Russian Review and Russian Language Journal. He's the author of After Newspeak, Language, Culture, and Politics in Russia from Gorbachev to Putin, and Speaking in Soviet Tongues, Language, Culture, and the Politics of Voice in Revolutionary Russia. And he's an expert on language and political culture in Russia and the impact of social media on Russian politics. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining the fiscal year 2022 National Defense Authorization Act, which has hawks on both sides pushing to add an extra $24 billion, even though the U.S. is ending its wars in the Middle East. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Kelly Vlahos, who's a senior advisor at the Quincy Institute and editorial director of Responsible Statecraft, the former executive editor of the American Conservative, where she wrote about U.S. war policy, civil liberties, foreign policy, veterans, and Washington politics. She's on the board of PublicSquare.net, a nonprofit media project promoting informed left-right debate, and is the co-host of the Crashing the War Party podcast. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kelly Vlahos.
Thank you, Ian. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for joining us. And of course, the National Defense Authorization Act is now being negotiated. And well, first of all, there's 800 amendments have been offered. Obviously, only a fraction of those will reach the floor. Ro Khanna has an amendment to stop supporting the Saudi Arabia's blockade of Yemen and helping the Saudis with their airstrikes, etc. There's also another amendment on the 1033 issue of military equipment, the militarization of American police that became an issue after the murder of George Floyd. But hawks on both sides, both Republicans and Democrats, are now adding $25 billion. That'll take it up to what, $778 billion? Is that, what will the total figure be?
Well, the total figure from the base defense bill would be $740 billion, but I believe that there's probably several more, maybe double that, like $20 billion more if you include all other budgets that deal with defense. But if we're just talking the stripped down, you know, DOD budget, it would bring it up to $740 billion. I'm just saying that just take into account that there are other agencies within the Washington military industrial complex that feed into the overall defense spending of the United States government.
Well, I think it's worth noting, though, that the defense budget is deliberately, artificially held low, even though it's unbelievable and astronomical, and I think we spend more on defense than the next 11 possible rivals combined. The fact that the Coast Guard is in the Department of Transportation, that the nuclear weapons are in the Department of Energy,
right,
and a lot of the pensions and stuff are also being shoved off into other departments, that doesn't seem to be something that's often talked about, Kelly.
Oh, you're absolutely right. It is artificial. And when you do put in, it's particularly after 9/11, when you think of how many other agencies aside from the Pentagon had been feeding into our post 9/11 counterterrorism homeland security effort, that would not only include the Nuclear Energy Administration, but also the Department of Homeland Security, the FBI, even HHS had a hand in it, the State Department. And so, you know, several of our top agencies had been involved in the global war on terror in one way or another. And so when you put all that together, this the defense spending goes way beyond that $715 billion number, which is still, you know, about flat with a slight increase over the last year's budget. We've never really had a flat budget in many, many years. I don't even know when. I don't think ever, much less have a decrease in spending, even though we've gone from war to peacetime several times. You know, in the last 75 years, the budget just keeps going up, up, and up.
And of course, both Republicans and Democrats are piling on, and the press, by the way, is also piling on with this chorus of criticism of Biden's withdrawal from Afghanistan. So the same people who are complaining about us pulling out of Afghanistan after 20 years of getting nowhere, they don't have a problem with spending more money when, you know, we're pulling out of countries. So our profile in Iraq is down to, what, a couple of thousand. In Syria, it's down to about under 1,000, I think. So there's no connection, it seems, Kelly Blayos, between what the so-called wars that the U.S. is involved with and the defense budget.
Right. And I've often said that our defense budget doesn't match a real defense strategy. It's as though our defense strategy only exists to serve, you know, the budget. And so, yes, we are finally withdrawing from Afghanistan after 20 years. And that sound that you're hearing from Washington is a collective shiver from the military-industrial complex, because everyone's worried that the gravy train is somehow getting turned off, the spigot rather. And so now you're seeing members of Congress starting to respond to the different armed services, the lobbyists for the defense contractors, who are unbelievably active in this town, and they're finding other ways, other threats to respond to so that they can keep that spigot going. And so now that's why you're hearing about counterterrorism and how we need to put more money in that. We're hearing about China and that growing threat, the, you know, great power competition that we need to respond to. We even have an amendment in the NDAA currently for putting more troops on the Russian border for NATO exercises and for deterrence from the Russian threat. And so, yes, we're out of one war, but that doesn't mean that our engagement in conflict has ended, because as long as that means a constant slush fund for the military and its handmaidens in the defense industry, we're just going to keep those conflicts going.
And again, I'm speaking with Kelly Blayos, who's a senior advisor at the Quincy Institute and editorial director of Responsible Statecraft, the former executive editor of the American Conservative, where she wrote about U.S. war policy, civil liberties, foreign policy, veterans, and Washington politics. She's on the board of PublicSquare.net, a nonprofit media project promoting informed left-right debate, and is co-host of the Crashing the War Party podcast. So this is, of course, we saw the kind of absurdity of it all during the big debate over the $1.2 trillion or whatever it is, the bipartisan infrastructure bill that was finally debated and agreed on. Now, of course, it's held up because of bargaining over whether or not to put the $3.5 trillion first. But that, the fact that the Senate was wrangling over this bipartisanship, which they finally came up with a product, I couldn't believe that they're having difficulty
investing in America, investing in mainstream America. They were arguing about what to invest in, what not to invest in. At the same time, leaving behind tons of equipment in Afghanistan. It's never made sense to fill potholes in Kabul and not in Main Street USA. So this is the part of it that I don't get. Why is it so difficult to invest in improving the lives of Americans and American infrastructure and all the things that have been deferred and haven't been invested in, which in many ways is making us look like a third world country compared to the Europeans, for example. But that's hard to get anybody focus on. But the one thing that they are absolutely, they will rubber stamp, both the Democrats and Republicans, is defense spending. So why has it become this sort of sacred cow? And when you talk about a left-right debate, if there's no left-right debate in terms of the defense budget, how do we start a left-right debate in terms of investing in America itself and in all of these deferred needs?
Right. I mean, I hate to give the cheeky response, but I will say one word: lobbyists. I mean, and everybody inherently assumes that there are more lobbyists for defense industries than there are for poor people or educators or other domestic interests in Washington. But it's absolutely true. Aside from the financial industry and the healthcare industry, they have a tremendous army of lobbyists here in Washington. But let's just look at the defense firms. My colleague at Responsible Statecraft wrote up a piece just a few weeks ago talking about how the top defense firms, we're talking the top five, you know, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Boeing, and the rest, they spent $1 billion on lobbying during the Afghan war. So that's 20 years, but $1 billion lobbying. They got $2 trillion in return in terms of federal contracts during that period. So they got a massive return on their lobbying. What is lobbying? Lobbying is them not only giving campaign contributions, but sending armies of representatives of their companies into Washington to talk to the military, to talk to members of Congress about why they need one specific weapon system funded, why they need more F-35s, why they need more Ford-class, you know, naval ships. This goes on in perpetuity in this town. And so when it comes to the NDAA or the infrastructure budget or other big budget initiatives, you know, most members don't want, they know where their bread is buttered, first of all, and a lot of them are getting tons of money for their campaigns. But there's also an ethos in Washington that's this is an interest that you don't want to go up against. And then add to that the fact that many of these major weapon systems, these programs that are costing us unbelievable amounts of money, like the F-35, which is the biggest defense boondoggle in American history, it's spread in terms of its manufacture over many states, if not most states of America. So these members are afraid to vote against adding them to the budget because their opponents in the next, you know, election cycle can turn around and say, well, you know, Representative Smith or whoever doesn't mind getting rid of 1,000 jobs in Florida or North Carolina, I guess, because he doesn't want the F-35, you know, program to be, you know, doubled or whatever. And so by spreading around all of these jobs, and we're talking about many jobs, but we're talking about enough to be to be a concern or a worry for a politician to oppose. And so you have this on a level where every weapon system, every ship, every aircraft, you know, is sort of seeded in each of these states. And that's how the defense industry is able to maintain this grip over members. So when it comes to a budget like this, you know, every member has its own, you know, its own like special, you know, a wish list, and the military has their wish lists, and they collude with the members on the Hill, and they pack, you know, these budgets full of things. And then the hawks go, well, if you want your infrastructure bill, you want your education and your roads and your bridges and your jobs programs, then you have to give us what we want. And that's how you, every year when it comes time for NDAA, you don't ever see decreases. You see increases in the defense budget.
And since many of these defense contractors rely almost entirely upon federal dollars, I mean, they have very, as far as I can tell, they don't have a lot of other private sector contracts. They're mostly government contracts. Does that mean that, in effect, federal dollars are being used against the American people? In other words, federal dollars go into the lobbying?
Yeah, you're right. And when you look at it, it's a welfare program. If we're keeping Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman and Raytheon and the other top five members alive through federal contracts, it's a inflated economy, and it's a welfare system that tax dollars are paying to keep these companies afloat and keep their CEOs in the gravy, really, with bonuses every year and super duper multi-million dollar salaries. People call the Pentagon and the military industrial complex a self-licking ice cream cone. But it really is, and it is an economy that would not survive in a real free market system, because you have programs like the F-35 that the cost of which has doubled and tripled and then some over the last 20 years, and the planes still don't fly right, and they still fail all their tests. And in any other system, free market enterprise system, that contractor would have been fired 20 years ago. But this is how it works. And when you do have five major defense contractors who get all the contracts for all the systems, the ships, the aircraft, the drones, the bombs, and then all of the services that are required now that we outsource everything to the private sector, that means that you are shoving out competition from younger, scrappier, more efficient companies, because they can't compete with these huge contractors who have tons of money, who don't, you know, they can plan their budget several years ahead because they have money in the bank. So we've created a system where it's a real trough for five major companies, but it's a real downside for U.S. taxpayers, because we're getting overcharged all the time, and for competition in general. And considering that they're building bombs that are killing children in places like Yemen, it's a real downside for people who live in countries that, you know, we are targeting all of the time.
So just in closing, Kelly Vlahos, obviously, it's all about this kind of Rolex mentality, when in fact the military really need a Timex, because it's rugged and reliable.
Right.
And what happens is you get these complicated weapon systems and aircraft and stuff like the F-35 that is grounded all the time. They're all hangar queens because they have to be, their stealth coating has to be replaced. The same with the B-2s. So, you know, the Taliban just beat the United States with old Russian equipment, a lot of it 20, 30, 40 years old. So there you can see that this is a racket. So let's just quickly go through the big ticket items here that are being extra funding that's coming in, the 24 extra billion. You mentioned the F-35 program, $3.6 billion earmarked for just four new warships for the Navy, another $567 million for production of the Virginia-class submarines, attack submarines. We've got about 68 of them, haven't we, already?
Just give us the number, yeah.
Yeah. So, and then you got all these military construction projects. So this is where the money's going, right? And just good money after bad.
Yeah, it is. And nobody ever asked, and I wish there were a hearing on the Hill. If I had my druthers, I would plan this hearing on the Hill about why it costs so much to make these ships, these submarines, the F-35. when other countries make effective weapon systems of equal quality for much cheaper. No one ever asks why we seem to be getting rooked by these big five contractors. Now, we know why nobody asks, because they're getting campaign contributions. They're cozy with the lobbyists, you know. So it's a an incestuous relationship that doesn't allow for questions and oversight and accountability. And it's very frustrating. We had a Pentagon auditor. It was a top person in the Defense Department. Actually, President Trump had appointed this person during his first year of office. They were fired. Then the Congress defunded that position. They have never replaced the Pentagon IG. Now, as a taxpayer and as an American, I want to know who's watching how my taxpayer dollars are being spent. And it's unbelievable how the Congress is in collusion with these defense contractors and the military to make sure they get what they want, but nobody's looking out for the taxpayer.
Well, Kelly Blais, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much. I love talking about it.
Well, thanks. And again, I've been speaking with Kelly Blais, a senior advisor at the Quincy Institute and editorial director of Responsible Statecraft, the former executive editor of the American Conservative, where she wrote about U.S. war policy, civil liberties, foreign policy, veterans, and Washington politics. She's on the board of PublicSquare.net, a nonprofit media project promoting informed left-right debate, and is the co-host of the Crashing the War Party podcast. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. If you missed any of today's program or would like to explore our vast archives, you can find us at backgroundbriefing.org, where we include extended interviews searchable by topic and have made it easy for you to sign up for daily email updates that provide links to resources, articles, and books discussed on the program. Also, you can find links there to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And we also encourage you to rate and review us on those platforms. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Masters Media. And please do help us reach more listeners by sharing this program with friends, family, and colleagues. To help us sustain this program into the future and ensure it remains free to all, please take a moment to support us by going to backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where you will find our nonprofit Public Truth Media Foundation, where your tax-deductible donations, large and small, keep us broadcasting. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing at backgroundbriefing.org. Bye for now.
The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared by half.